So, as usual, before we get started, let us reflect on the fact that it is because of the infinitely compassionate Gautama Samma Sambuddha that we have this Dhamma today. It is because he dedicated his life, not just the last life that he lived as a human being, as a sentient being on this in this universe, but also an infinite number of lives throughout samsara, ever since he had affirmation that he was going to be a Samma Sambuddha at the feet of the great Samma Sambuddha Dipankara. From that point forward, despite having the opportunity to become an Arahant, he dedicated his life knowingly that there awaited great amounts of unsatisfactoriness, pain, suffering. And as we know, ever since he has also on occasion been born an animal. If you look at the Jataka Pota Hanse, where he relates stories of his lives as a bodhisattva, there are oftentimes we come across these stories where he was born in the woeful plains as an animal, and how and how life in those times or how life as an animal was painful, of course. And it's the same hells that he then, having become a Buddha, asked us to avoid, or advised us, instructed us to avoid. So it takes someone with quite literally an infinite amount of compassion and kindness to jump into a bowl of fire knowingly to save beings who are not even personally known to him. If you think about it, back then when he was a bodhisattva, he dedicated his life, he committed himself to that cause, and he did that for you and for me and for all of us. And yet, it's hard to think that he would have known us personally. So it's compassion without bounds, it's compassion without borders. And it's hard to imagine, really it's hard to imagine how someone could be so compassionate, how someone could have so much kindness in their heart. But that is what it takes to become a Samma Sambuddha, and that is the virtue that he fulfilled, that is the practice that he fulfilled, and thus achieved the greatest attainment a human, a deva, a brahma can ever achieve. So that was to remind ourselves of how much the Lord Buddha sacrificed for all of us. And therefore, before we commence the sermon, let us all venerate the infinite qualities that the Lord Buddha possesses. Let us mark our respect to the Lord Buddha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Let us also take a moment to pay our gratitude to all those beings who we may have come past in samsara, those sentient beings who may have been our teachers, our parents, our brothers, sisters, our relations, and anyone who may have helped us get where we are today. Today we are born human beings, but that may be the result of, and that most almost certainly is the result of, a countless number of people, countless number of beings, devas, brahmas, etc., having committed themselves and having sacrificed their time, their efforts for our salvation, even in the worldly sense. So they have done so much for us, and this is why today we have the opportunity to be born human and practice the path to liberation. So today, as we have this opportunity to practice this path, let us extend an invitation out to them. Our past relations, our parents in our past lives, and perhaps in this life if they're not with us any longer, devas, brahmas, and anyone else, all kinds of spirits, demons, anyone, quite literally anyone, who may today be at least in some way possible or some way able to listen to the Dhamma, may they all gather with us, rejoice in the merits that we are about to acquire. If they are born in woeful planes, may they rejoice in the merits that we are about to acquire and be born in the blissful plane. And having done so, may they attain the noble bliss of Nibbana in this birth itself, or in that very birth. So, as I make this invitation, please join me in extending that invitation out to all of these people, to all of the devas, all brahmas, and also let us remind ourselves, I would like to add on this occasion, there are a great number of people who work behind the scenes to make these sermons possible. It's important that we take a moment to remind ourselves of this. For our listeners, it might just be a case of switching on your computer or using a mobile device. You go onto YouTube, you punch in the URL, or you click on a link on Skype potentially, and you are able to listen to the sermon. But there are lots of people who put in a lot of work and a lot of effort to make that possible. You see, normally when things are simple, when things seem simple to those who come to take, oftentimes those who deliver put in a lot of work and effort. And it's exactly that in this case as well. There are those who work tirelessly to make sure that this Sunday afternoon sermon goes ahead as planned, to make sure that the Deshakyanan Mahanse is available and has the appropriate technology, the environment required to do the sermon, to deliver the sermon, as well as make the technology available, as well as make the equipment available, and then of course make the recorded sermons available for offline listening for those who are not able to join us live. And then I have also been made aware that efforts are currently being made to transcribe these sermons, which is an absolutely wonderful thing to do. So there are listeners among you, and this is what I really do appreciate, there are listeners among you who take the time out of their day jobs, sometimes other commitments, to replay these sermons and then sit in front of a computer and type them out into a document for the sole benefit of others, so you can share this out with other people. Quite frankly, there will be people who are unable to hear, if they're hard of hearing, for example. All we need to try and do is actually to try and get this Dhamma out to as many people as possible, to as literally as many people as possible. I'll discuss a little bit more about why we need to do that and how you may be able to help with that. But before that, let's make that invitation. Let's all join together to make that invitation. So in your minds, in your hearts, please open that invitation now to your distant relations, devas, brahmas, and any one of those beings you would have come across in sansara who might have offered you a glass of water or might have just shown you the way if you were lost at some point. Today we have the Dhamma, today we have the path to liberation and to salvation. Let us open this opportunity out to them so that they may join us, they may listen to the Dhamma, they may be born in the blissful plane, and they may seek refuge in this Dhamma to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Samanta chakvalesu atra gacchantu devata saddhammam munirajas sunantu sagmokkadam Dhamma Savana Kalo Ayam Badanta Dhamma Savana Kalo Ayam Badanta Dhamma Savana Kalo Ayam Badanta. Let us also take a moment to remind ourselves that throughout our journey in samsara, we have not been as kind and as good as and as virtuous as we are today. And that is just a reality. Let us accept that truth. Let us accept the fact that the majority of times in samsara we have only had the opportunity to associate ignoble people. People who would have asked us to do bad things, do wrong things, and who might have deliberately kept us away from seeking a happiness that is never ending, a happiness that goes beyond the material happiness that we have always been looking for in life. And in having associated with ignoble people, we may have not been able to identify with noble people, moral people. And in having done so, there may have been times when we may have done, said, or thought, or had thoughts even, which were insulting to them. We may have been unkind, ungenerous to them, and every time we used bad words, every time we passed words of insult or slander to the Aryas, to the noble people, that would have been a karma which would have accumulated bad sins or bad vipakas. And the unfortunate case is that today when we have the Dhamma and we try to listen to the Dhamma to understand it and to try and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, those karmas and the karmic energy that we would have released into the universe really does come to bite us on the back. And they block our path to wisdom, our path to enlightenment. It may be the case that those noble beings, the Samma Sambuddhas, the Pacheka Buddhas, the Arahatun Vahanses, as well as the Anagamis, Sakurdagami, Sotapannas, both on the path or those who may have attained the fruit, may not be with us today. But we still have a way to seek their forgiveness. This does not mean that this eradicates all the vipakas of those karmas. The vipakas will come as soon as the opportunity for that arises. As soon as there is the samanantare, then the anantare comes in. We have discussed how that works to some extent in the past. So those vipakas will bear fruit, or those karmas will bear fruit as vipakas at some point. However, what is unfortunate is that what we did then is now blocking our path to liberation, our path to wisdom, our path to knowledge that helps us and gets us to a place so that we can stop doing those bad things in the first place. Otherwise, it's just a never-ending cycle. It's a continuous, never-ending loop that we need to try and break here. So, now that we have the opportunity to associate with noble people, let us use their words of advice, their words of wisdom, and seek forgiveness from all those Aryas who we may have insulted in the past in samsara. Please, let's take a moment to do that. In your minds, make a firm determination that for all those times when we have all been unkind, when we have been ungenerous, and when we have insulted Aryas, may they find kindness and compassion in their hearts to forgive us. May the energy of the noble people, noble beings, forgive us for the upavadas. This is what we call the Arya upavadas. May we be forgiven for those Arya upavadas. May we be forgiven for those Arya upavadas, and may we be forgiven for those Arya upavadas. So make a firm determination. Also make a firm determination to attain the noble fruits of Sotapanna, Sakrudagami, Anagami and Arihat. May this sermon help you all achieve that. May this be the sermon where any barriers to your supreme knowledge be unblocked or be removed. May this Dhamma sermon contain the key messages that you require to clarify any doubts that you might have. Of course, you have the opportunity to pose any questions you have, and that opportunity always exists. We're streaming live on YouTube as well as Skype, so please drop those questions there. But in either case, even if you do not make the effort to drop those questions, make a determination that during the course of this sermon, may you be able to attain those noble fruits. Okay. So as I was saying at the beginning, there are a great number of people that help us make these sermons possible. And it's important to take a moment to reflect on that, because, well, you know, one might think, what is the relevance there to Nibbana? And this is the unfortunate situation. You see, oftentimes we are all so ambitious, we want to attain Nibbana, and you know, you listen to the Dhamma, you listen to Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta, and you come to the conclusion, well, there's nothing in the world that is to my liking. When I attach myself to anything that is conditioned, then of course that brings me suffering, and all that whole process is just useless, it's futile, it's essenceless, so let me just go ahead and attain Nibbana. Now that's easier said than done. I'm sorry to lay it out so blandly, so bluntly, but that is literally the case. As you have just done and reflected on the fact that, you know, in our countless times in samsara, in that countless time we have spent in samsara and in all those births, we have not always been good people. We have done lots of bad deeds through mind, through speech and through body. And in having done so, we have caused great hardship, discomfort and pain and suffering to a lot of people, to a lot of animals and other beings as well. And so today, when we try to attain Nibbana, when we make that determination, having at least achieved a modicum of understanding, those karmas do really come to back bite us in the back. Chickens do come home to roost. Those consequences of the things we have done, we have to tolerate. They do come and bear fruit. And this is why it's important to understand that to attain Nibbana, of course the knowledge and the understanding you need is Anicca Dukkha Anatta. But that itself is not sufficient, because you need the environment that helps you gain that understanding. If you have been catching up on some of the English articles we've been writing to Hellabodu Puma, which is a monthly magazine publication that goes out on a Poya day, you might have followed the recent descriptions we've been doing about the meritorious deeds, and I encourage you all to do that. The magazine is available as a PDF, in PDF format online, and there's also the printed version for those who wish to get hold of a copy. I think they are available in Sri Lanka. I'm not sure if they get shipped internationally, but you are able to download them on the website. So in this description of the meritorious deeds, I have often emphasized the fact that these meritorious deeds are absolutely essential. And put me to a side, the Lord Buddha has on countless occasions emphasized, he couldn't have emphasized enough, the fact that meritorious deeds are absolutely necessary for one to attain Nibbana. The reason that these meritorious deeds are essential is because it helps create the environment for one to have the mental ability and the mental aptitude to understand the Dhamma. Now, we may have discussed in the past, if I remember vaguely, that we have talked about three kinds of births in the blissful plane. Or at least, birth in the blissful plane, so the three kinds being, you can be born as a human, as a Deva, and as a Brahma. And then even if you are born as one of these three, you need to understand the Dhamma, to actually understand the Dhamma. And I'm not talking about memorizing, I'm not talking about being able to memorize and repeat. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm quite literally talking about understanding. So understanding is one thing, and then just remembering is another. To give you a very simple example, I could teach you to work out a math problem, but if you understand how to work out that math problem, I could give you another problem and you will work it out yourself. But if you just memorize what I've told you, what I've taught you, then you'll be able to repeat and solve the same problem, but as soon as I give you a new problem, then you're going to fail. You're just going to come back and say, well, you didn't teach me how to solve that problem. Well, the theory is the same, the method is the same, you just need to work out how you apply the method in that new example. And that is the difference between understanding something and simply knowing something or just gathering knowledge. You remember in one of the previous sermons we talked about Kala and his son Kala Siddhaputra, where Kala's son used to go to the Buddha, and the Buddha determined may Kala's son be able to gain the wisdom but not remember the words that I'm speaking. So this is the practice that we are doing right now, is to gain that understanding, not necessarily remember or just gather information. That is not the purpose of these sermons. It never will be. And quite frankly, if you want to attain Nibbana, yes, you need to understand this, but there is not really a need to memorize or remember what is being said. It's a case of understanding. Understanding is what's important. It's comprehension. If you are going to preach the Dhamma, then of course you need to understand some of these concepts. You need to remember the words, you know, some perhaps technical jargon, if I may use that word in this context. You'll need to remember some of those words, but that's for people who preach. If you just want to attain Nibbana, then it's the understanding you need. In any case, we were talking about meritorious deeds. Even if you're born a human, you still need the environment that is conducive to attaining Nibbana. Conducive is supportive. And that environment is one where you have the basic comforts that you require. So, if you're hungry, if you're feeling really hungry, then I could sit down in front of you, and perhaps even the Buddha might sit down in front of you and start preaching the Dhamma. You're not going to be able to understand a word of it. In fact, there's even a story where the Buddha once visits a gathering, and there are a number of bhikshus or a number of monks who come and gather around him and sit by his side, and they await for the Buddha to start the sermon, a discourse. But he doesn't, and he waits for quite a while until this one person, he was actually a peasant, a farmer, until this farmer who goes home after having worked for the day, washes up, gets ready, puts on some clean clothes and comes and sits down. And the Buddha the Buddha patiently waits for this person to come and join the sermon. So he doesn't start until such time. And then everyone's baffled as to why the Buddha waited for one person when there were, and that person was not a monk, clearly, as I said, he was a farmer. And then there were monks who were sat in front of the Buddha, so they're all wondering, why is it that the Buddha did not start the sermon? Why did he wait for just a normal lay person? To which the Buddha responds, well, it's because, I think it's towards the end, and in his conclusion he says, the reason I didn't start the sermon is because this person is the only one that's going to attain. I knew that this was the only one that had the environment, the conditions required to attain a noble, to achieve a noble attainment. A Margapala. None of you have been able to do that today, and therefore I do not waste my words, I do not waste my energy. This is why I waited for him to come and join us, and so I have preached today with him in mind. Now, this is in no way to say, well, the rest of you are useless. That's not, clearly not what he implied. What he's saying is that there's a deeper message that we need to get here, to try and understand here. You see, that person was just a farmer. He was not a monk. He had not donned robes. So you and I might think that to attain Nibbana, what we need to do is to sit down, listen to a sermon in which anicca dukkha anatta is being discussed, and perhaps if I've donned robes and I've become a monk, then all the better. Listen to one or two sermons, and I will be able to attain the noble fruits. Well, it doesn't quite work like that, as I said before. It's because you need that environment that is conducive, and you need to have created that environment. So how do you create this environment? You create this environment by accumulating merits. What do I mean by environment? Let's be clear. This environment is, I give one example where if you're feeling hungry, if you're feeling really hungry, then your mind is not with the sermon. Your mind is not able to absorb and understand and comprehend what is being taught. I mean, think about when you're in class, at school, or perhaps in a meeting at work. You're feeling really hungry, you're famished. No matter how much effort the person that's talking or presenting is making, very little, if anything, of what is being presented is going to stick with you, because your mind's going to be, in your stomach. You're just going to be thinking about, how am I going to quench my hunger? Where am I going to get some food? That's what you're going to be thinking about. Or perhaps if you have a really bad headache, then all you're going to be thinking about is that. Where can I get some medicine? I just want to lie down. Or even perhaps if you're feeling really tired and sleepy. And I'm sure you'll have been in at least one of those situations where there's a sermon, or you know, it could be religious, it could be non-religious, there's a or some kind of presentation, and you're just not feeling up for it. That's either because you're feeling weak or you're feeling ailed, either physically or mentally. Now that is not a conducive environment for you to listen to the Dhamma, or any kind of presentation for that matter. And very little, if at all, or anything is going to stick with you. This is why, when you listen to the Dhamma, it's important that you have that frame of mind. And that frame of mind is a result of lots of different conditions. It's your physical health. So don't be fooled that just because you have made a determination that I'm going to attain Nibbana in this birth, well, why do I care about my health anymore? That's not important. If you're thinking like that, I'm sorry to say, but you're deeply mistaken. Very, very mistaken. Your physical health is very important. It's your physical health that's going to create that's going to give you the mental health and the mental frame of mind, or the frame of mind that will help you to listen to the Dhamma without obstruction, without interruptions, and understand the Dhamma. So that's important. And just as much as being not being hungry, that's not to say you've got to fill yourself up so much that you can't keep awake. Now that's the other end of the spectrum. That's not helpful either. So you've got to find this middle ground where you're physically feeling fit, physically you're feeling ready, and therefore that does not interrupt with your mental mindset and your frame of mind at that time. So I hope that is clear to those who perhaps might have been under some kind of delusion, or maybe the some misunderstanding, let's say, that if it's Nibbana you want to attain, I don't care about how I look anymore, I don't care about my health, my diet doesn't matter anymore, I don't need to wash, I don't need to shower, and I'm sure there'll be people like that. This is probably why I'm talking about it right now. So please don't fall into that trap. That's just craziness. And I completely take it. There are people who do that, and there are sometimes recluses who practice that. Let's be quite, think about our Bodhisattva, Siddhartha. Before he became a Buddha, and when he lived the life of a recluse, and he practiced extreme asceticism, he didn't wash for long periods of time. His hair was disheveled, and he, physically he wasn't feeling fit at all. And this is why he said, "Atta kilamatan yoga," or inflicting extreme levels of pain, discomfort, and hardship on your mental and physical self are not going to help attain Nibbana. It's just the Eightfold Path that you need. Okay, so please do remember that, and please, if you have been going the wrong path, then it's time to set it straight. Okay, so now we were talking about meritorious deeds, because it's meritorious deeds that help you have that mental and physical soundness of to be in a state that is sound both mentally and physically. No matter how much you want, if you don't have the merits that you might have accrued by donating alms, by giving to the poor, by helping other people, perhaps even animals, you are not going to be able to have the merits to be able to quench your hunger or thirst. You're not going to find food, and if all it requires is for one to open their eyes and look around the world and observe how many people are there out there who can't feed themselves on a daily basis, and then people who don't have a home, people who can't clothe themselves, human beings. This is the blissful plane, remember? This is the blissful plane we're talking about, the Sugatis. And yet they're unable to find food or clothing or shelter or medicines if they're ill. This is because they don't have the merits that reward them with these good fortunes. Now, if you don't have any of those things, then you don't have the physical or mental frame and background and environment to be able to both listen to and understand the Dhamma. So, merits are extremely important. Now, I'm not going to go into detail of these merits because I want to try and focus on the Nibbana. But again, I repeat, you absolutely need these merits. But if you're interested and if you want to find out more about what these merits are, how can you accumulate these merits, and what the Buddha has taught us about merits, and how not to shy away from them, but to quite deliberately, intentionally, and find every opportunity possible to go and accrue these merits, then please do read those articles in the magazines, and perhaps I'll add a link onto YouTube once we're done with the sermon, so you have a link to go and find these magazines. Or if there's a listener among us then who has the link, then please be kind enough to jot that down either on Skype or on the chat window. But I'll remind on this occasion that the gift of Dhamma is the greatest gift there is. Dhamma danang sabba danang jinati is in the Buddha's words. There is no gift that excels the gift of Dhamma. So the gift of Dhamma is actually what we're doing right now, by preaching the Dhamma, and by also, as I said at the start of this sermon, all of those deeds that all of us, all of you, do, either individually or collectively, to organize these sermons, to invite your friends, your families, to your colleagues, to listen to these sermons. Perhaps there are, and I'm aware that there are some of you who get together on a Sunday afternoon, at your friend's place, or perhaps at a convenient place, and then you listen to the Dhamma together, and that's such a great thing to do. You see, I'm conscious of the fact that a lot of our listeners will not be local, so they'll not be from Sri Lanka. They'll be in countries outside of Sri Lanka. Now, there is of course the obstacle there that I'm unable to see you when we use this medium for preaching the Dhamma, and of course you can't see me. It's not essential to be able to see the person giving the sermon, and it's not essential for me to be able to see you, but of course where we have the possibility to do that, then it's always helpful. Even if you look at the Tripitaka, there are most of the stories where people have attained the fruits of Sotapanna particularly. Let's leave the other attainments to aside, but Sotapanna, because once you become a Sotapanna, then you know the path is open to you, and you can fulfill your own path from that point forward. But to become a Sotapanna, you need to associate a noble person, a noble being, and you need to have their to be in their proximity, let's just say, to be in their proximity when a sermon is being delivered is extremely helpful. Now, I'm aware that even when our Guru Swaminwanse does these sermons, there are a lot of you, and I probably even say the majority of our listeners, still join online, and that is quite possibly the same. And I know for a fact that is the case with these English sermons anyway. So, but what you can do though is, rather than listening by yourself, if you're able to get together with friends or family or colleagues, and you know anyone that has an interest and perhaps lives local to where you are, then get together if you have the possibility to do that and listen to the sermon together. There are many benefits to doing that. One of the benefits is actually when you're both focusing on the Dhamma, and you're both, you know, that's your frame of mind, and that's where your mind is when the Dhamma is being preached, then you're both generating lots of good karma and lots of good energy, which you're continuously releasing into the universe. Now this energy can be helpful to not just yourself but also someone else who's with you. So if there's more than one of you that's sat down and listening to this, then the energy that each of you release and generate is going to help each other mutually. And that's such a great thing. So you have the benefit of actually associating noble people even without actually being able to look face to face or look eye to eye with the person that's preaching the Dhamma at that point in time. You know, because let's be honest, you all have been listening to this Dhamma for some time now. So without a doubt, you'll all have at least some understanding of this Dhamma. You'll have some understanding of Anicca, some understanding of Dukkha, and some understanding of Anatta. And you are all listening to this Dhamma because you want to attain Nibbana. So in that sense, you're all trying to remove yourselves from the world and move away from mundaneness into supra-mundaneness, from the Laukika to Lokottara. Therefore, to have your association, for your friends to be around you is really a privilege. Friends, family, etc., etc. So, where you have that opportunity to do that, then please do that. That helps. And secondly, the second benefit I see in doing this is that it's possible that sometimes when you're just sat in front of your computer or your mobile device, I promise you I can't see where you are right now, so this is just my thoughts of what you might be doing right now. I'm sure there will be some of you who will have their YouTube open on one window and you're listening to this, but you're probably multitasking right now. You're working away on something else. Perhaps you're playing some kind of computer game. Perhaps you're watching TV and you're watching with your eyes, but you've got the sermon plugged into your headphones and that's over your ears. Or maybe you're doing your homework. Maybe you're doing something else. This is normal, because that's what we're always used to doing as human beings. It's very difficult for us to focus our minds on one thing at any given time. This is why we're still in samsara. Okay, even when we have the opportunity to listen to the Dhamma, we still can't find the continence to control ourselves and focus our minds on one thing. Again, this is not me telling you off. I have nothing to gain by doing that. All I'm suggesting here is because I know what I was like when I used to not necessarily listen to the Dhamma, but when I used to work and play or perhaps, you know, do my homework or perhaps even listen to someone. There were times when I used to multitask, and then you're not doing either of those things correctly. So the reason I'm mentioning this here is if you are prone to doing that, then where you have the opportunity to sit down with somebody else, at least one other person, and provided the two of you don't start chit-chatting with each other and you are both able to focus on the sermon, then it helps to have that other person so that he or she can keep you in check, and vice versa. So you're both keeping an eye on the other person. Now that's not to say keep your eyes on the other person and check that his or her he or she is behaving. That's not what I'm asking you to do, because your mind has to be on the Dhamma. That's what you need to be focusing on. But what I'm suggesting is, when you have that environment where you have someone else around you, then you're less prone to focus your mind on other things, because you know you're being watched. I hope you can you'll understand the essence of what I'm saying here, and that you find that helpful in some way. So, meritorious deeds is what I was talking about a minute ago. Now, just as much as preaching the Dhamma and listening to the Dhamma are both very potent meritorious deeds, disseminating the Dhamma in whichever shape or form you can is also very meritorious. This is why I said at the beginning, we should be very grateful for those of you who have already started to transcribe these sermons. What that means is type them up in plain English. To listen to these sermons a second or third time perhaps, and then type them up onto a Word document or a PDF of some sort, and then to make them available for offline reading rather than listening, because there are people who may not have the opportunity to listen to them, look to these sermons, but may still find value in reading, and that is, there's absolutely good value in doing that. So, and that is an extremely meritorious deed. So when you do these deeds, what you're really doing is you're accumulating lots of good merit that will then help you when you sit down to listen to a sermon, when you sit down to practice the Dhamma, when you sit down to meditate. All you need to do is make a determination, may any merits that I have accumulated by helping somebody, by helping someone attain Nibbana, by helping someone to attain Nibbana, may those merits now help me in my search for liberation, in my practice of this meditation. And all that is required. And it's amazing how much it can do. So, if you're interested, if you have the time, then please drop a message onto our Skype group, and I'm sure there'll be our listeners who will provide instructions on how that can be done. Again, there's certainly no obligation on you to do this. And if you don't do this, no one's saying you can't listen to the Dhamma, and no one's also saying that you can't attain Nibbana. You can attain Nibbana, of course you can attain Nibbana, but all of these merits will help you walk that path easily. If you're trying to follow a difficult path right now, then there's no harm in trying to make it a little bit easier. Imagine you had to walk home, you had to get somewhere, or you're walking somewhere, you're leaving home, and there's pebbles on the ground, or there's sharp stones on the ground, then why walk barefoot when you can put some shoes on? And it's quite the same here as well. You'll still get to the same place if you walk the walk, then you're going to get to the same destination, but that journey can be made easier if you have the merits to help you do that. So that's just an invitation out to anyone who may be interested, who might have some time. Then drop a note onto Skype, and I'm sure there'll be our listeners who will provide you with the opportunity to help with that. Now, last week we discussed we talked about chocolate cake, I think, and we were talking about how each of us creates a world inside ourselves. The Lord Buddha quite clearly said dukkho loke patittita, by which he meant the world is located, or the world is placed upon dukkha, on suffering. The world is based on, the foundation of the world is suffering, is what he said. Now, I was thinking about this, and I thought perhaps this can use a little bit more explanation, description, because it's easy to get the wrong idea when talking about this. Now, an arahant who has eradicated all kinds of suffering, except for the suffering that comes with the karmas that they might have done in the past bearing fruit. So the vipakas, for example, an arahant feels hunger. The Buddha feels hunger. The Buddha had to endure certain kinds of physical aches and pains. All of those are vipakas. And for as long as you have this physical body, then you will have to endure those pains and discomforts. So we all live in this world. Now an arahant has eradicated the pain that can be eradicated while still being alive, or the suffering that can be eradicated while still being alive. What do I mean by that? Let's just go back to the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths, the first being the first noble truth, that of suffering, the second noble truth of the cause for suffering, the third noble truth being the cessation of suffering, and the fourth noble truth being the path to cessation of suffering. Now, if you're clever enough, you'll have done some research yourselves, you'll have done some study, and have noticed that it does not say anywhere that the path to cessation of suffering is death. The Buddha never says that, die and that's the end to suffering. Why do you think that is the case? Because if you think about it, if I'm hungry, if I'm ill, if I'm feeling weak, and I've lots of discomfort, and you know, as we have sometimes actually discussed in the past, there's this practice called euthanasia. Punch it into Google, not right now. Keep your focus on the sermon. Later on, euthanasia, it's where people opt to have this procedure done onto them, which results in their life being ended. So I think what they do is they inject a certain kind of drug into your body, and then that stops your vital organs from functioning, and then that's, you know, the last moments of your life are taken away at that point. And normally people do this when they are under immense physical pain and discomfort, and they no longer can bear and tolerate that pain, and they feel that dying is the answer to this problem. But I would like to emphasize the fact that the Buddha on no occasion did he advise this practice. He never advised this practice. So you might wonder, well, I have heard, this is probably why you're thinking right now, the Buddha 3 months before his Parinibbana made a determination that I will attain Parinibbana in 3 months' time. Isn't that a way of kind of, you know, thinking to yourself or making that affirmation that I no longer want to be alive and that's enough for me living? Well, that applies to arahants and it applies to Buddhas, but so this practice is called letting go of your life vitality. So there's a, you know, there were certain arahants that used to do that, and they did that because they, well, in the Buddha's case, he had made a promise to the Mara that once he had established his ministry, the Buddha Shasane, and there were enough monks who were practicing the Dhamma, and there were enough arahants, or there were plenty of arahants in the world, and he had done his service to the universe, to the world, then he would let go of the life life faculty, and that is what he did in the premises of Chaitpala, the Chaitya. But this is not a practice that he advised on anyone that is not an arahant. Why? Because that's not the answer to the problem. It's not the answer to the problem that the Buddha came into the world to explain and to teach us. It may be the answer to a different kind of problem, but it's not the answer to a noble problem, and it's not a noble answer. Well, are we not tired and exhausted by having practiced and done all of these ignoble things and tried to solve ignoble problems and all these material problems and material answers. Isn't that why we are still today in samsara trying to find the end to this useless and meaningless existence? Well, yes, of course. So this is why we need to think. We need to be intelligent. We can't just be doing things just because someone else does it. And unfortunately, this is where the world is today. You see, because of the association of immoral people and ignoble people, and we get to know about the things they do by reading newspapers, by watching TV, by going on Facebook, and I'm not telling anyone off for doing any of these things. That's not my duty. But what I am saying is, these are the avenues through which the world attacks us, approaches us, and contaminates our mind. So be very careful. Be extremely careful. When you're on the internet, when you're tapping away on Facebook, when you're watching TV, when you're reading newspapers, magazines, whatever the case may be, be extremely careful and be extremely mindful. If you're mindful, if you practice Satara Satipatthana, then you'll be okay. But if not, then the world's out to get you and the world will get you. As long as you allow the world to contaminate your mind, as long as you allow the world to put this kind of stuff into your mind, then guess what it's going to do? Because that's how the world makes a living, of course. How does Facebook make its money? Well, I'm sure there's lots of things that they do, but advertising is going to be one of the main sources of revenue. Now, I haven't done any research into Facebook, but knowing how social media works, this is how it will work. This is why that tool is free. Have you not heard the expression, if something is free, then it's not that object that is being sold. It's the recipient of the object that is being sold. So if something's given to you for free, then it's not that thing that is being sold. It's you that's being sold. How so? Well, if you take the example of Facebook, you're probably thinking, why are we talking about Facebook? And why are we talking about all of these things when you're just listening to this sermon to attain Nibbana? This is what I said at the beginning. Nibbana, yes, understanding Nibbana is about understanding Anicca Dukkha Anatta, but you need to create the environment for that. Otherwise, how long have you actually been... How many sermons have you listened to right now? We've probably got about 15-16 sermons online, and there are also others that haven't been published. So if you've had the opportunity to listen to these sermons, you know, we've been talking about Anicca Dukkha Anatta, we've been talking about the five aggregates, we've been talking about Dukkha, Viparinama Dukkha, Sankara Dukkha. All we've been talking about is Nibbana. Have you attained Nibbana yet? Have you become an Arahant yet? Well, if not, then you need to think about why that is the case. And that is what I'm saying. Yes, you need to understand. We all need to understand Anicca Dukkha Anatta. But to do that, and while doing that, we need to create for ourselves the physical and mental framework and the background and the foundation that we need to get there. So this is why I'm talking about this. So as I was saying, if you take Facebook as an example and how these tools and these avenues are used to contaminate young people's minds, that's not to say Facebook cannot be used for good things, by the way. Lots and lots of good things are shared on Facebook. We stream some of our sermons via Facebook. So, but what happens is, because how does Facebook make their money? Well, if you're not paying for it, then it's normally done via some kind of advertising. And the advertising firms are paid to bring you, the readers or the viewers, to their site, to that portal, and then that's how they make money. And therefore you're the one that's being sold. Never knew that, did you? So that's what you need to think about. Now, to bring anyone to that kind of place, whether that's TV or whether that's watching a movie or whether that's reading a newspaper, what does the world do? The world throws at you the things that you're always looking for. In the material world, we are always looking for sights so we can please our eyes. We're looking for sounds so we can please our ears. Sensual pleasures I'm talking about here. Tastes which go well with our tongues. Physical comforts that go well with our sense of touch. And just the same for taste as well, and sound and smell as well. So if this is what sensual beings are looking for, then guess what? This is, you know, what they're doing is fishing, and they're using nice and beautiful pictures of things that are attractive. That could be physical objects, it could be people. These are the baits that are used to fish you. You're being fished. Full stop. You are being fished, and that's the bait. So you go on the site. Along comes a bit of bait tied onto a string, and that could be a picture of a young girl, or it could be a picture of a really smart car. And you're thinking, oh, that looks pretty. That looks nice. I want to go have another look at it. Now you're baited. Now you're caught at the end of the line, and you, from that point forward, you have no idea what's going on inside your mind. You are not practicing Satarasatipatthana. Because if you are, then you will be thinking about Anicca Dukkha Anatta. For any moment you are not, your eyes, your sound, your ears, your smell, your nose, your tongue, your body, for at any moment when any of your senses are being pleasured, sensual pleasures I'm talking about, and you're not practicing Anicca Dukkha Anatta, well then you're not practicing mindfulness. You are not practicing mindfulness. That's a plain and simple statement. This is why you need to think about what you're doing, and you need to not fall victim to the antics of the world, and to try and be mindful and keep away from them. And this is why you need the association of noble people, because noble people and noble dhammas, as in the Buddha Dhamma, will always talk about the consequences of doing these things, of seeking sensual pleasures and the results of doing so. So when we are trying to, when we make this effort, a deliberate and strong effort to attain Nibbana, if we don't have the environment, then we're in trouble. And therefore we need to create the environment for us to be able to do that. Now, we were talking about how this world is created for us, right? So this world is this world that is based in dukkha does not exist for an arahant. Again, let me go back to the statement I made at the beginning, or a few minutes ago, where I said the Buddha says, when he uttered the words or the phrase dukkho loke patittita, dukkha being obviously suffering, loke being the world, and patittita being based on or founded on, placed on. Okay, so the meaning there being the world is placed on suffering, the world is located, situated on suffering, based on suffering. If an arahant is someone who has eradicated suffering, then he must be someone who has removed himself from the world. But as we know, an arahant still lives in this world. This is why an arahant can see you. This is why an arahant can go on alms and eat when he's hungry. This is why he will don robes. This is why he can use the toilet or go and wash himself. So clearly he's interacting with the world that you and I can see when we open our eyes, when we open our ears. You know, the world that we sense through our six senses, well, an arahant senses as well. So if the world is based on dukkha and he has eradicated dukkha, then obviously we have to come to the we should be able to infer from that If dukkha has been eradicated and the world is based on dukkha, then the world has been destroyed. But he interacts with the world. So clearly then, we're talking about two different kinds of worlds here. I hope that makes sense to you. We're talking about two different kinds of worlds here. There's the one world that we interact with, the world that we experience through our senses, and then there's the world that's based on dukkha. And therefore, the world that's based on dukkha is not the world that the Buddha says is out there, as in the world that we see with our eyes. So, if you walked outside your front door right now, and your back door, and you looked at your garden, or perhaps your front yard, you're going to see a world. You're going to see grass, perhaps. You're going to see your car in your garage. Or perhaps you're going to see people walking up and down the street. Perhaps you're going to see your neighbor's house. Now that's all, that's the world that you can observe through your five senses. You can see those sights, you can hear people talk, you can hear birds and animals, you can smell the flowers, you can taste the grass if you really wanted to, you can taste, say if you were stood in front of the sea and you're on the beach, then of course you can taste the sea, you can taste the saltiness of the air, in the air, and you can feel, you can put your arms out, you can put your feet on the grass, and now you're feeling the world. Well, an arahant can do exactly the same. An arahant can do exactly the same. But if we are saying therefore that an arahant, if we are saying that an arahant has eradicated dukkha and the world is based on dukkha, then once you've destroyed the foundation, well, of course, whatever was stood on the foundation prior to that can no longer stand. So if the foundation that is dukkha has been destroyed, then the world that sits on top of the foundation can no longer exist. So you have this conundrum. There's a world that still exists for an arahant, and yet we are talking about a world that has been completely and utterly destroyed. So that concludes that there are two different kinds of worlds. We can draw the conclusion from there that these are two kinds of worlds that the Buddha is talking about. Now one kind of world an arahant lives in and we live in as well. And that's the world I just talked about, where you walk out your front door and then there's a world in front of you. But there's another kind of world then that has to exist. Well, let's think about it this way. Imagine an arahant has a twin brother who is not an arahant. Okay? So twin brothers, one's an arahant, the other is not an arahant. When you look at them, say they have both donned robes, okay? One's a novice monk and has not attained the fruit of arahant yet, and the other has. So obviously, again, you have two monks, one's an arahant, one's not an arahant. When you look at both of them, what do you think you're going to see? You're going to see a carbon copy of one, or you're going to see a carbon copy of each other. They're going to look identical. Well, perhaps maybe the odd difference in the way that they've donned robes, etc. Or perhaps, you know, one might have maybe shaved their head. But if you ignore the subtle differences there, at first look, you're going to see that they look identical. So then what is the difference? Where's the difference? If it's not in the looks, where is the difference? Is it in the robe? No, well, because they're both wearing robes. So it's not in the clothing, it's not in their physical looks. Well, then clearly it's got to be in the mind. Right. So if it's in the mind, let's go back one step again. An arahant has eradicated suffering. The world is based on suffering. And therefore, the arahant has eradicated and destroyed the world. And we're looking at an arahant and a non-arahant and saying the difference between the two is their mind, is their state of mind. So if with the change of state of mind, I mean, even if they're twins, one would have been an arahant, the monk who's an arahant today let's say he became an arahant overnight. So the previous day he was not an arahant. So what's changed now is their state of mind. Where there was raga, dvesha, moha, where there was desire, aversion and delusion, that's raga, dvesha, moha. The previous day, there is no aversion, delusion and desire today. So his mind is free. His mind is free of defilements. His mind is free of defilements and his mind is also free of what? Well, the world is no longer exists for him. And the world we're talking about again here is not the physical world. I can't emphasize that enough, and I hope this is making sense to you, as I can't use body language because that's not of no use to you. Right now I'm trying vehemently to try and create to use my arms to show a world on my left hand side and another world on the right hand side, and it's dawning onto me right now that's not helping you one zinch. So I'm going to stop doing that now. But hopefully the idea is clear to you, and that is the world that has been destroyed, removed, annihilated for an arahant is not the world that you and I see when we open our eyes in the morning and look out through the curtains and the window. Okay, it's another kind of world, and that's the conclusion that we can draw from that argument. So that's the world then that is based on suffering. Now, if that's the world that's based on suffering, and the Buddha talks about the Four Noble Truths, and nowhere does he say that the answer to removing suffering, eradicating suffering, is going and hanging yourself, then he's talking about a suffering that can be removed in this life itself. He's talking about a suffering that can be treated, that can be eradicated in this life itself. So one does not become an arahant against, you know, sometimes popular opinion. There may be some of you who think, or others perhaps, you know, you might have listened to other people say that you become an arahant after you've died. That is not the case. You become an arahant before you die. If you are to be, if that is your last birth, then you absolutely become an arahant before your last chitta, vitya. Before that last thought process runs, you become an arahant. So that you need to remember. You become an arahant in this birth, not after death. That might be your last birth, in which case you have achieved arahathood before you passed away. But arahathood is not something that is achieved after you have passed away, and then you are born in, say, another celestial world, which is just for arahants. That's nonsensical. There is no such world where arahants go and be born. Because if birth is the problem, and you have eradicated, you put a stop to that problem, well then, you can't be born again. If you are born again, then you can't be an arahant. Simple. Okay? So then the world that can be eradicated is the world that gives us dukkha. Now what is this world then? So this world must exist in our minds. So if you remember last week where we talked about the chocolate cake, we used this example of a chocolate cake where the waiter brings a chocolate cake, puts it down on the table, and this chocolate cake is, this chocolate cake is inedible. Inedible because there's, let's say it's plastic. So there's plastic in this chocolate cake. Put plastic to a side. Let's say there's, someone's put something in it. Someone's put some spices into it. Let's say pepper. Someone's dropped a jar of pepper into the cake while it was being made, and not knowing this, the baker continued to make this cake, and it was baked, and out comes a cake from the oven, and actually guess what? It's got pepper in it, all over it, on the inside. So you can't see it from the outside, but on the inside there's pepper, and all it would take is for someone to take a slice of it, put it in their mouth, and without a second thought they're going to spit it out, because you're not going to be able to eat it, let alone taste the cake that one expects. Okay, so that's the kind of cake that we're using for our example here. So the waiter brings this cake, lays it out in front of you, and now you're ready to eat that cake. You're ready to eat that cake. So what do? You use a knife, you slice up this cake, a slice of that cake goes onto your dish, and you open your mouth, and now you put that cake inside your mouth, and now you're chewing away. A moment passes, a second moment passes, a third moment passes, and it hits you. The taste of pepper, that scorching taste of pepper hits you like nothing you've expected. Well, clearly you didn't expect that because you wanted to eat cake. So, did the pepper not exist in the cake before you put it into your mouth? Well, of course it did. That's how it got into your mouth in the first place. So then, if the pepper existed in the cake, and you at that point, having looked at the cake, thought, I'm going to eat this, why did you eat it? That's because the cake that is in your world did not have pepper in it. The cake that exists on the outside, in the outside world, had pepper in it, and anything else that you can imagine that goes into a cake. But if, for example, you were a chef yourself and you knew how to make a chocolate cake, well, then you'd obviously know all the ingredients that would need to go into the cake that's sitting right in front of you, except of course for the fact that there's pepper in this cake. That would not cross your mind because that is not an ingredient for making cake. But the cake that went into your mouth had pepper in it, and the cake that sat in front of you had pepper in it as well. But the cake that exists in your mind does not have pepper in it. This is why when you look at the cake that's outside, that's on the table, that the waiter brought to you a moment or 3 moments ago, you couldn't wait to take a slice of that and shove it in your mouth. So then think about this. Did you actually eat the cake that was outside on the table, or did you eat the cake that was in your mind? That is the million-dollar question. Which cake did you think you were eating? Or which cake were you actually eating? Because if it was the cake that is outside and you can see with your eyes, you would never have eaten it because that cake has pepper in it. Of course, you can't see the pepper, but that doesn't change the fact that there is pepper in it. But the cake in your mind, well, that does not have any pepper in it. In fact, that's delicious. It's quite sweet as well, if you prefer it that way. So this is the cake that you ate. Let's take that example one step further. Let's imagine for a moment there's cake, but there is no pepper in it. So the cake is perfectly fine, and it's edible, right? It is very similar to the cake in your mind. Now your slice is cut, put on a dish, and served to you. You now start, you put this piece of cake into your mouth, and you're chewing away, and then I ask you to stop. Quite abruptly, I say stop, and you stop chewing. Now I say, can you spit that cake out onto the dish that you had the cake before? Please don't try this at home, but you get the idea. So you spit that cake out onto the dish, and now I ask you to place that bit of cake next to another slice of cake that's on a dish. So remember, there was a big cake, chocolate cake, very similar to the cake in your mind. There's no pepper in it, okay? It's got all the right ingredients. 2 slices cut, each on a dish. You picked up one of these dishes and you started eating that cake, but before you had the opportunity to swallow, I asked you to spit that bit out onto this dish, and now I'm asking you to place that dish next to the other dish, which has a slice of cake that is perfectly, it looks edible. The other one's still edible, but It doesn't look edible. Why? Because it's been inside your mouth. Of course. Now, this is where the problem comes. I now ask you to take that cake that came out of your mouth and eat it again. How would you feel? Would you readily take that dish back and what came out of your mouth, would it go back as quickly into your mouth as it did the first time when it went in? Or would you be extremely reluctant and perhaps even completely unwilling to do as I am asking you to do? Why so though? Well, it's the same cake. The two dishes have exactly the same cake, and this piece of cake that went into your mouth, well, it's got saliva, of course, but how are you ever going to eat a bit of cake without saliva going to be all over it? Even if you picked up the other dish with the new piece of cake, that's still going to be covered in saliva. It's going to be chopped up into your mouth. It's going to be squashed inside before it goes down into your stomach. So the cake that came out of your mouth is just one step closer to going down to your stomach. That's the only difference. But why is it that you're finding it difficult to put that into your mouth now? Well, the answer to this question is, or to this riddle, is in the fact that the cake you're eating, well, this is where you got to ask yourself, are you now eating the cake that's in front of you? Are you eating the cake that has been laid out onto the dish? Or are you eating the cake that's in your mind? When you see the big cake that was brought to you, you looked at the cake. Being a baker yourself, you knew all the ingredients that go into it: flour, water, icing sugar, sugar, chocolate, and anything else that goes into cake. Okay, butter, whatever, right? All those ingredients you know, and there's a cake that's inside your mind, and that's the most delicious chocolate cake that you would have tasted. So now you're ready to have that cake. Remember when we used the example of the pepper cake? Well, it's not pepper cake, it's chocolate cake with pepper. You still ate it, because as we agreed, it was the cake that was in your mind that you wanted to eat, not the cake that's laid out in front of you. But now you've got two options. You've got the slice of cake that is fresh, you've got the slice of cake that came out of your mouth, and what else? Well, you've still got the cake that's in your mind. Guess what cake you're eating now? It's still the cake that's in your mind. This is why you can't, or you find it, you'll struggle. You really will struggle. I mean, if you are still able to take that cake and put it back into your mouth, well, that's great. I mean, again, I repeat, please do not do this at home, particularly if you have visitors, because if your parents see you do this, if your family sees you do this, they're going to ask you, where did you learn to do that? And then you're going to say it's through Dharma or by English sermons, and that will be the last time you're going to listen to one of these sermons. So please don't do this at home. This is just an example for you to think about what goes on in your mind. Hope that's clear. Right, so you're looking at the cake, you have the three options. The cake that's been sliced fresh, the cake that you just spat out, and the cake that's in your mind. The reason you're going to struggle to eat the cake that has just come out of your mouth is when you look at that cake, guess what is not going to happen? You are not going to be able to eat the cake that's in your mind, because the cake that just came out of your mouth looks nothing like the cake that's in your mind. However, the fresh slice of cake that has been cut out onto another dish that sits right next to that slice of cake that came out of your mouth, that looks a lot like, very much like, the cake that's in your mind. And therefore you're willing to eat that cake. Again, not because you're eating the cake that's out there, because what you, for all intents and purposes, you're just eating the cake that's in your mind. You're eating the cake that's in your mind. What this piece of cake that's outside and in the world outside is doing is just helping you recall that cake that you had, say when you were really young, or the cake that you saw on the chocolate cake that you saw on TV, or the chocolate cake that you saw on a TV advert, or the chocolate cake that you saw at the bakery on your way home from school, or on your way home from work, right? There was a beautiful decorated chocolate cake that was on the on the shelf in the shop window, and you thought, that's I'd like a piece of that. So that chocolate cake was in your mind, and now having looked at this chocolate cake that's sitting in front of you, you're thinking, right, it's time to eat that chocolate cake, but that chocolate cake is the one that's in your mind. Now, we discussed this not to this length at the last in the last sermon, so I hope having revisited that example, it helps you to further clarify and understand the concept of, well, you know, we live the world that we have created for ourselves. That is the essence of what I'm trying to express here. The world we live in is the world that we have created for ourselves in our own minds. This is why you can't eat the piece of cake that came out of your mouth when it has exactly the same ingredients as the fresh piece of cake, plus of course the saliva, but that saliva is going to be in your mouth before you swallow the fresh piece of cake anyway. So there's no way you can eat a piece of cake without saliva. Agreed? Well then, why is it you cannot eat that cake that already has your saliva on it? You got to think. This is what we need to think. This is how we need to analyze the Buddha Dhamma. Remember, the Buddha Dhamma is nothing if not practical. It is extremely practical. It is the most practical teaching and philosophy ever. The Buddha never said, I have now spoken, go and think about what I've just spoken, but use my examples and do as I say. He never said that. What he said was, here is the philosophy. Here's how you need to look at your own lives. Yoniso Manasikara. This is what you need to do. Take examples from your own life, apply the philosophy, apply the theory that you've learned, that you've taken from this, into your own life, into your own life examples, and see how they fit. And if whether that's cake, whether that's pizza, whether that's macaroni, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't even have to be food. It can be anything. It can be clothes for some of you. Again, you know, think about what is it that always attracts you. What is it that you struggle to remove strong feelings of desire for. Use those examples. In fact, sometimes there are people who come to me and say, Venerable Sir, I try to meditate, and you know, I've been listening to your sermons, and I try to practice Anicca Dukkha Anatta. I reflect on the defilements of desire, aversion and delusion in my mind, and I try to bat them away using Anicca Dukkha Anatta. But when I sit down to meditate, my mind runs AWOL. It just goes all over the place. And I've sat down trying to do Anapanasati, but before I know it, my mind's thinking about how I had dinner the night before, or perhaps how I met with a friend of mine and we were talking about something useless most of the time. And this is when I say, well, what you need to use as your object of meditation is then you've just found the object you need for your meditation. Why do you think our mind always runs places? Why does it go everywhere, all over the place? Think about where you go on holiday most. Where do you most go on holiday? whether that's for a short weekend or whether you go on an annual holiday, where do you most go on holiday? If you have a habit of going to the same place, well, what you'll find is it's the place that you like the most. It's the place where you enjoy going to the most. It's the place where the sights, the sounds, the tastes, the smells, and the feelings of touch, texture, give you the most, the greatest sense of good feeling. And this is why you find yourself going back to the same place. Well, your mind is no different. Your mind is going to keep going back to the same mental objects that gave or that continue to give good feeling to it. And therefore, when you sit down to meditate, your mind's going to run here, there, and everywhere, and is always going to go to the places that it knows best. Well, rather than good feeling, let's just say it goes to the places that it knows best, because you know there are times when the mind runs to places where it brings you a lot of grief. Say, for example, you've just had a funeral in the family, a death in the family, and you sit down to meditate the following day. Chances are you're going to struggle to focus your mind on that, on your meditation object, because your mind's going to be thinking about the person that you lost, right? So it's wherever your mind goes most, where your mind is most attracted to, that's where your mind is. But in any case, whether it brings you feelings of pleasure or feelings of sorrow and grief, it's always going to be because that's what it has most closely associated and what it's clinging on to most. Whatever objects it's clinging on to most, that's where your mind's going to be. So whether that is a sight, whether it's a sound, I mean, these are the things that come into your mind when you start to meditate, is it not? It'll either be a sight, you know, something you saw, something you heard, so it could be a music or a song, something you tasted, perhaps some food that you had, it could be something that you smelled, maybe your most favorite bottle of perfume that sits in your cupboard, okay? Or it's something you felt through text, through your body. So perhaps, you know, it's your sofa, your new sofa that you find really comfortable, or your bed. I mean, some people they sit down to meditate and all they can think of is their bed, but that's mostly because they just want to get a nap. And just like sleeping. But anyway, in any case, this is what the mind's like. So if that's where the mind likes to go and dwell most of the time, and to become an arahant and to attain margapala, attain these or achieve these noble attainments, is about finding out where the mind likes to dwell and then realizing and reflecting for oneself that these places are worthless, are useless, are futile, are essenceless, asara, okay? If that is what we need to do, well then, do we need to look elsewhere? If we know for certain that this is where my mind spends most of the time, this is where my mind dwells most of the time, well then, that's where you need to try and remove yourself from. But then you don't do that by force. You don't do that by pulling your mind away and kind of telling your mind off, saying, how dare you think about something else when I've taken all this effort to sit down cross-legged, I've got myself everything I needed, and I've sat down and I determined to sit down for half an hour, and 2 minutes into my meditation practice you ran away and I didn't even know you were gone. That's not what you should be doing. The mind is great at being a teacher. The only problem is, we're not good students. That is the problem. That's always the problem. There's nothing wrong with the teacher. The problem is with the student. If the student is ready, who appears? I'm sure you've heard this expression. When the student's ready, the teacher appears. Well, of course. When you're ready, when the mind knows, when you know that what I need to meditate on, what I need to find and cleanse of defilements, are the places and the things and the objects and the people that my mind likes to dwell on and dwell around and dwell in, then these are the mental objects that you need to focus your meditation on. So if it's something that you saw, and let's say it's it was a pretty girl or a boy, or perhaps a flower, or perhaps it was a really smart pair of shoes, right? And you're thinking, I really want to get my hands on that, or I really want to make that mine, and that's where your mind now begins to dwell on. Well, you don't need to ask anyone else, what should I be doing anicchedu kanata meditation on. You've got the answer yourself. It's exactly that you need to do your anicchedu kanata meditation on. Because to try and practice anicchedu kanata on anything else, have you not experienced yourself that it's a useless effort? Isn't that why people come running to me and saying, running to us and all meditation masters and say, I'm struggling to focus my mind? By the way, I'm not saying I'm a meditation master. I'm just saying people do come to us with these questions, but I am not a meditation master. So, isn't this why though? People come to us and say, I'm really struggling to focus my mind. I'm trying to keep my focus on my breath, but my mind keeps wandering. Well, then you've got to go to where the mind is wandering and teach the mind that why do you keep coming here? Just imagine you have a friend, right? A friend that you care about, a friend that you want to show the right path to, but this friend, you know, you want the friend to go to the temple or the church or the mosque, okay? Every Sunday you want to take your friend with you to go to the temple, to go to the mosque, to go to the church. It doesn't matter where you want to go to, okay? But this friend has other plans. He always wants to go out to the park. Now, if you know that he's just wasting his time going to the park, he's not really gaining anything worthwhile to his life, he's just wasting his time, it would make more sense for him to go to the temple, then what would you do? Would you go to the temple and then shout out to him, say, hey, come out from wherever you are, come to the temple? No, well, if you do that, guess what's going to happen to you? You're going to get kicked out. You can't shout in the temple. What you're going to do is you're going to go to the park. You're going to go to the park and you're not going to drag him out of there. You're going to sit down with him. You're going to ask him, hey, why do you keep coming to the park? What's so special? You can ask him. You're going to ask him some really good and some really interesting questions, to which he's going to have to give you some answers. What do you find so fascinating about the park? Why do you keep coming here? And then he's going to give you some honest answers. He's going to say, well, these flower beds, they look really pretty. I can't help but take my eyes away from them. And then you're going to ask the question, well, these flowers, are they to your liking? Have they ever been to your liking? Do you not see the flowers that are just next to them? Those flowers which have withered now, you know, they have before, 2 weeks before, those flowers that have withered and are dying right now were just the same as those flowers you're looking at right now and enjoying the look of. And then you're gonna get him to think, and you're gonna then explain to him, well, if you attach yourself to these flowers and you think, oh, what beautiful flowers there, and I want to keep coming back to see them, well, 2 weeks time from now, guess what? What's gonna happen to these flowers that you're looking at right now? They're gonna wither and they're gonna die. The petals are going to fall, and they're not going to look as pretty as they look today. And then guess what's going to happen to you? Of course, you're going to feel sad. You're going to feel disappointed. You're going to feel frustrated. Who's going to save you then? And then all you're doing right now is you're sitting down with your friend, and you're explaining to him that the world that he fancies and he finds pleasure in is anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Meaning, it's not to your liking, it's just conditioned, and therefore, what is conditioned, if attached to, will only bring you suffering. Because, why? Well, you should all know this by now. As soon as the conditions change, the result changes, and therefore, if you're attached to the effect or the result, then you're attached to something that is in constant flux. And that is a useless thing to do. It's a pointless thing to do. And therefore you're going to say, so if you now understand that, is there a point in attaching yourself to what you're looking at right now? Because the more you look at it, the more you're going to be attracted to them, and the more you want to keep coming back here. And the more you don't reflect on the reality of what you're looking at right now, the more you're going to feel attached to this. And then you're going to come back tomorrow, you're going to come back the day after, you're going to come back in 2 weeks' time, and you're going to see that these flowers don't look as pretty as they did 2 weeks ago. And then you're going to feel sad. Why dig a hole for yourself? Isn't that what you're doing? You're digging a hole for yourself. But if you come with me to the temple, where we talk about, we can go and speak to a monk who will explain to us that just like these flowers are anicca dukkha anatta, well, so is everything else in this world, because everything else is conditioned. And in that temple we can sit down and we can reflect on that. We can talk, we can discuss about other things that you might find yourself attracted to. Now ask him, would you like to come with me to the temple? Is he going to say no? No, he's going to come with you. He's going to come very willingly. But if you were at the temple and shouted, hey, where are you going? Come here, what are you doing? Well, he's not going to come to the temple. He's just going to keep walking away from you because you're being annoying. And secondly, you're going to get kicked out. So, the point there being, the mind is just the same. When the mind starts dwelling in other places where you don't want it to dwell, understand that that is how the mind is. You don't fight the mind. You want to be your mind's friend. Because, quite frankly, the mind has enough and plenty enemies already. Everything in the world is an enemy to your mind, is it not? Why is it an enemy to your mind? Well, think about the flower bed. The mind likes to go and dwell, the mind likes to go and attach itself, because the mind sees sensual pleasure and it likes to enjoy. But the world is not to the mind's liking, and therefore the world changes constantly. And when the world changes, because despite the world changing, the mind is still attached to what it saw before, what it heard before, what it tasted before, what it smelt before, and what it felt before. And now when the result has changed, the mind is going to feel disappointed. It's going to feel sad. So, didn't the world make the mind sad? Didn't the world give rise to... Didn't the world show all these beautiful and pretty pictures and pretty sounds and pretty smells and pretty tastes and simply lure the mind in, only to disappoint it after all? How cruel a world that is. So, all the mind has is enemies. Every single object, every single person out there, from the tiniest grain of sand to the Himalayas, to the little baby child to anyone that you can think of, to the most beloved member of the family, they're all enemies. Please take this sensibly. I'm not saying your family are your enemies. Please understand that we're talking about the mind here, and why the world is the mind's enemy, because the world is conditioned. The mind is not looking for a conditioned world. The mind thinks the world is to its liking. But it's not to its liking. That is the problem. That is what the Buddha comes and teaches us. This is what the Buddha comes into the world and teaches. The world is constantly and forever conditioned, and all of those conditions are anicca and dukkha and anatta. Okay? So if the mind has all these enemies and all these things and all these objects are all the mind's enemies, why should you be yourself the mind's enemy as well? Well, then who's going to be a friend to your mind? You ever think about it? You've got to be the mind's friend. You've got to be kind to it. You've got to be compassionate to yourself. If you don't be compassionate to yourself, no one else is going to be compassionate to you. You've got to be kind to yourself, otherwise no one else is going to be kind to you. Well, no one's going to be kind to you anyway, so at least you've got to be kind to yourself. So, when the mind is wandering, our job and our duty is not to yell at it, not to scold it, not to shout at it, So please don't do that when you feel your mind's doing that, when you sit down for meditation. What you need to do is to go along with the mind, help it understand, be a good teacher to the mind, help the mind understand that whatever it's dwelling in, whatever it finds pleasure with, and whatever it lures the mind in, is only a trap. And when the mind realizes that this is only a trap, the mind's going to run away. It's not going to stay there. It's going to come with you. It's going to be tamed. And that's how you tame your mind. That's how you tame your mind. It's not by being... you don't be feisty. You don't be angry at it. You don't be an enemy to it. You be a friend to your mind. And that's how you tame your mind. That's how you be a friend to your mind. So, the problem is then, coming back to how we create these worlds, the mind is constantly creating these worlds. And to create these worlds, it uses the rupa, the vedana, the sanya, the sankara and vijnana. And we've discussed this a few weeks now, but this is kind of a recap, going over some old material, but all useful, because this is bringing together several topics that we discussed recently. Now, when the mind uses the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana, so again, rupa being form, material form, vedana being feeling, sanya being recognition or identification, sankara being formations, and vijnana being consciousness. I shall use the Pali terms because they just flow freely. So rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana. The mind uses these dhammas, the rupa dhamma, vedana dhamma, sanya dhamma, sankara dhamma and vijnana dhamma, to create to create the world that it then lives in. And this is the world that the Lord Buddha says is based on dukkha. Now, does an arahant create these worlds? Of course he doesn't. This is why an arahant is able to see the world as is. An arahant does not create a new world inside their mind. They observe the world and they interact with the world, but they don't create a world artificially for themselves. And it's because the problem with creating these worlds is that once you've created the world, you then expect the world outside to match the world you've created. You expect the world outside to be similar to the world that you've created. And then therefore, once you've created this world inside your mind, you go out into the physical world, let's call that the physical world or the external world, let's call it the external world and the world that we've created ourselves, the internal world, okay? So, once we've created the internal world, we go out into the external world looking for objects, looking for people, looking for things, looking for occasions and incidents that match the internal world that we've created. Now, this is what brings us an enormous and infinite amount of suffering. Because the world that we created is based on the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara and vijnana that we liked, we wanted and we clung on to. But the world that exists outside is conditioned, and that is in constant flux, it keeps changing based on what goes on outside. Now, if you think about, let's take a simple example, the rose bed again, going back to that example. So you have the rose bed, the friend that's looking at these flowers, he's looking at a fresh bed of flowers, he's looking at some yellow flowers, some red flowers, some orange flowers, and some purple or violet flowers. He's looking at these flowers, and when he's looking at these flowers, the world that has been created inside of him resurges. It comes to the surface. It comes to the surface from where? It comes to the surface because all of these dhammas, the rupas, the vedanas, the sanya, the sankara, and vijnana are all in his upadana, or clinging aggregates. These are the aggregates that he's clung onto in the past when he first came across these, and now by looking at the world outside, it recalls these dhammas inside of his mind, and they come to the surface. And when they come to the surface, this guy is now in a constant battle trying to match the outside world with the inside world. Well, the problem is, the inside world is constant, because the inside world is to my liking. Because I can change the inside world if I wanted to. I can change the inside world, because that's based on my thoughts. It's based on what I know about the world outside, and it's based on what I'm ready to accept about the world. But the outside world is not to my liking, because that is based on conditions. And when the outside world changes, that no longer matches the inside world, and guess what happens? Well, we have conflict. And that conflict is what brings an enormous and endless amount of suffering. So of course we're talking about a bed of flowers, but this applies to absolutely anything out there. Applies to people, applies to objects. Again, as we said before, yoniso manasikara, what you need to do now is to take this principle and apply it to examples in your life. See where there are, see how it matches, see where you did the same perhaps, and think about, it could be anything really. The last time you went out to a restaurant and you ordered a meal, were you eating the, when you walked into that restaurant, having seen all the adverts, having seen the boards that are outside the restaurant, having listened to perhaps, having seen the packaging of the food that has just been taken out by the person that was stood in the queue before you. You're not going to probably see the food, but you're going to see the packaging. And you're going to think, oh, that's what my food's going to be like. And the smell that you can smell as you drive into the restaurant. So all of these things are going to research the world that exists inside your mind, and that with that you set expectations. Remember, there was a sermon we did some time ago where we discussed expectation is the biggest culprit. I would encourage you to go back and listen to that. So expectation being the biggest culprit, what causes expectation is actually these rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana, and those mental formations that we have created in our mind. Once we create those things, then our expectation is that the world outside must match what is in our mind. And when we feel like they match, well, that brings us good feeling. When we feel like they don't match, then we feel disappointment. We feel unhappiness, we feel unsatisfactoriness, we feel sadness and sorrowness. So this is how the world we have created for ourselves brings us pain, brings us sorrow, brings us grief, brings us frustration. And that is the world that the Buddha said is based on dukkha. So when he says dukkho loke patittita, and he said the world is based on, is founded on dukkha, hopefully it should now make sense to you how this world that we have created for ourselves is what brings us this dukkha. Because we set those expectations, and then we go out into the world expecting for them to be met. And yet we forget that the world we go into is completely conditioned. Every bit of it is conditioned. Every inch of it every millimeter, every micromillimeter, every grain of sand, every tree, every house, every man, every woman, it's all conditioned. And the nature of things that are conditioned are, is that when the conditions change, the effect changes, the result changes. That change happens in the outside world, that change does not happen in the inside world, and of course you then have a mismatch. When you have the mismatch, you're in tears, you're in pain and you're suffering. So I hope that has been of use, and I hope that has given you something to think about. Once again, I remind you all, if you've got the time and you're interested in accumulating some merits which will absolutely and most definitely help you in your path on to Nibbana, because clearly when you do these meritorious deeds, such as transcribing these deshana or perhaps organizing these deshana, you know, it's just think about whatever your capacity is. Some of you will be able to do the transcription, others might be able to organize, others may be able to create posters, others might be able to send out invitations, others might be able to share out links, others perhaps might be able to produce a CD, whatever you're able to do. And perhaps, you know, it could be something as simple as just sending a link to a friend, because what you're doing there is disseminating the Dhamma. You don't necessarily have to preach the Dhamma. As long as you're disseminating the Dhamma, then you're given the greatest gift of all. You're given the greatest, you're doing the greatest charity of all. The greatest charity is the charity of Dhamma, because that is the Dhamma that helps us, that is the charity, or that is the gift that helps us achieve the ultimate happiness of Nibbana. Everything else is secondary, everything else is unmatchable. Nibbana is unsurpassable, it's beyond all kinds of happiness, it's beyond all kinds of bliss. Why? Again, because it's not conditioned. I have said this in the past, the path to Nibbana is conditioned. There are things we need to do, we need to listen to the Dhamma, we need to practice the Dhamma, we need to bear the Dhamma, understand the Dhamma, comprehend it, meditate, do all of these things. We need to practice meritorious deeds, we need to perform them to accumulate the merits. All of these are things we need to do to get to our destination, which is Nibbana. But once you're there, and that's it. Once you're there, that fruit, that result is not conditioned. No conditions can change the result of Nibbana, because it is conditionless. It is not based on conditions. That is the only thing you're ever going to find that is not conditioned. So when the Bodhisattva sat under the Bodhi tree and he reflected on all the worldly possessions that he had, the three palaces that he had to himself, the status of becoming an emperor that was his heir, and or his destiny, when he all the wealth that he had, all the material wealth that he had, and any material possessions that he had, all of those things were subject to death, to decay, to old age and illness. This is why he always looked for something that was beyond those conditions, that was beyond death, that was beyond illness, that was beyond death and decay. And the understanding that he came to was, for as long as I dwell on something, in something or around something that is conditioned, I'm going to have to suffer. Why? Because all conditioned things are subject to death, to decay, to old age and illness. The only thing that is not subject to decay, to death, to illness and old age is Nibbana. So once we've attained that, once we've achieved that, once we've fulfilled the journey, then ultimate happiness, for everlasting happiness, is with us. Let us, on this occasion, rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired over the last 2 hours of having discussed the Dhamma, preached the Dhamma, understood the Dhamma. May all those beings that we invited, the Devas, the Brahmas, the demons, spirits and so on, and all our distant relations that we invited, may they all rejoice in the Dhamma, that in the merits that we have accumulated, in performing this, this meritorious deed. May it help them all be, if any of them are born in the woeful plains, may these merits help them be born in the blissful plains. And having been born in the blissful plains, may these merits help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. May this land once again be a land where we get to see many arahants. May there never be a shortage of arahants again on this planet. May the Lord Buddha's Dhamma be restored in all its glory. May no one have to endure great amounts of pain and stress having to find the Lord Buddha's Dhamma, because this is the only path that we have to liberation. It is the absolutely only path we have to liberation. Everything else takes us in the world. Everything else teaches us to rejoice in the world, whether that is the physical world that you and I live in, whether it's the human world, the Deva world, or the Brahma worlds. But the only Dhamma that gives us the key to unlock ourselves from the shackles of samsara is the Buddha Dhamma, because the focus there is Nibbana. So may all those beings that we have reminded, that we invited, and anyone that we that rejoice in the in looking at and by complimenting, at least by word, by speech, or by action, what we have done today, what we, the merits we have gathered today, may they all be able to rejoice in these merits. Let us all transfer those merits to all those devas, to the Brahmas, and all those distant relations, past relations. May they all attain Nibbana in this birth itself, in the era of Gautama Samma Sambuddha itself. May all beings attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Theravan Sarnayam.